Thanks. It's good to see all of you. It is such a joy to be here, and I really mean that. I was thinking this morning, I was excited to talk more about what I'm going to talk about with you in a few minutes this morning, because it feels so live for me and for so many reasons so meaningful. But I also realized what was giving me the most joy was to think about being able to see all of you as I'm speaking, because you guys are awesome. And I think it's rare to be in a setting, at least for me, where I can look out and see so many people that I really admire and really care for. And so I was just sort of overwhelmed this morning thinking about how thankful I was for that. And so thanks for being that source of joy for me. But we are in the midst of this summer series around flourishing. Over the last few weeks, we've heard a lot of different voices and a lot of different angles on how to think about flourishing in the midst of different arenas in our lives. So it could be lack, it could be within our political environment, money, all of these different takes. And I thought this morning it might be helpful to continue this conversation in thinking about how we can flourish in the midst of heartache. I know for many of you, certainly for myself, this is a live beat given our current political and social climate, news that's come to the top over the last few weeks and months. It's left me feeling heavy-hearted at times. And this summer in particular, it's been a more acute personal note for me, with a story that I'll share more about in a little bit. But it's left me feeling this heavy-heartedness, this ache in my heart, and sort of battling with this notion of how is it then in pain that we think about flourishing? How do we even want to look for that? And so my hope this morning is that we can actually land somewhere together in a helpful state to think about those two being alongside of each other and not apart from each other in a way that actually illuminates the realness of what our lives can feel like and also illuminates the realness and power of God. So let me pray for us before we go down that road. God, I thank you for all of the people, as I've already shared, in this space this morning. Thank you for their hearts, that whatever state they're in this morning, I just ask for right now that your Holy Spirit would come and cover them, be in the midst of wherever it is they find themselves, be present, and be thick. In your name, amen. So for me, about a week before the official start of summer, I got some jarring news to some degree that my husband, Scott, was diagnosed with cancer. And we had been sort of on this road of trying to figure out what was making him feel unwell for about a year. We had done a medley of tests, gone to a lot of different doctors, bigger tests that sort of provoked anxiety, and all came back fine. And so we were sort of just being faithful to follow through with the motions of, you know, doing regular checkups, a physical. So it was in one of those appointments that Scott said to his doctor, you know, like, well, what about this little growth on the top of my ear? Like, should we do anything about it? It's been there for a really long time. And the doctor was like, well, I'm sure it's nothing, but since you're here, I'll just give you a referral. The dermatologist thought it was nothing, but we'll take it off anyway. And so it wasn't even on our radar, really, to be worried about that. And then 3 days later, we got a call from the doctor saying, indeed, the biopsy was malignant melanoma. And so that began this moment of my heart feeling intense pain. But let me say up front, and I think it's worth mentioning, that Scott's whole bout with cancer was 4 weeks in its entirety, from the moment of diagnosis on the phone to his surgery, where he had a bunch of lymph nodes out, and ultimately more of his ear off where that original site was. And then he had this very cool skin graft from his shoulder to his ear. So we then got to celebrate this new body part of his, this shoulder that we fondly refer to as, to the ultimate moment of hearing the words that I'm sure everybody wants to hear when they go through cancer, is that he was cancer-free. So he is cancer-free right now. Yes. But I flag that because I realize that pain and suffering for many of you doesn't abide within this tight, nice framework of 4 weeks. There's not a clear beginning often, and there's not a clear ending often, that it can spill out into long stretches of time for many of us. Yet in that one month, I was able to get in touch for the first time, I think, more acutely of this depth of pain that our heart can feel, how it can shut down really quickly, and for me, how it could shatter really quickly. And I'm hoping that this morning that's the commonality that I can hit on for all of us, regardless of time or source of pain. And it again is what got me thinking about, like, well, what does it look like to bring Jesus along in that pain in the way that doesn't just look like survival, but it actually looks like flourishing. I can imagine that some of you in this space are feeling heartbreak right now, whether it's from loss of a loved one because of sickness or violence. Maybe you've wished and hoped for a life partner to come onto the scene, and they haven't yet, and you're realizing, like, time's ticking. Or maybe that life partner left prematurely in a way that you weren't imagining. Maybe there's been levels of injustice because of the pigment of your skin or the makeup of who you are that has brought heartbreak to you. That's been for years, maybe a lifetime. However it comes, heartbreak seems to be this break between reality, our life that we actually have around us, our real circumstances, and what we know of the possibility among us. And so that possibility not being this fanciful possibility, like a dreamlike, wonderful situation, but possibility because it's what we've seen and what we know. So an example of this is the ability to see greed among us and to know that as a harsh reality. And then also to see generosity and know that to be true because we've experienced it, we've engaged with it. And yet it seems that the gap between those two will never completely close perfectly. That greed will never perfectly be eradicated. And generosity will never, in our human lifetime, maybe be perfectly fulfilled. And so we find ourselves in the tension of this reality and this known possibility. And so what do we do with that? How do we stand in the midst of that and not have our hearts broken over and over and over again on small scales and bigger scales continually? Wise voices say that we can't. That to be human is to have our hearts broken. And beyond Scott's cancer diagnosis, I've watched our nation and our world's stories be laced with this heartbreak, with violence and discrimination and injustice and drought and sickness and on and on and on. And in each of those situations, I can feel that heartbreak. And I can say, ah, oh, it's happening again. And I realize that it is true, that it's this heartbreak, at least for me, that feels like it's never ending. And I can imagine that this sounds pretty depressing. Like, how are we supposed to be human and keep moving in our lives in a way that, you know, would feel flourishing, like that feels audacious? How would we keep doing that if we're just heartbroken all of the time? So one of the ways I've been helped by this is by a man by the name of Parker Palmer. He's this wise 70-something-year-old. He's a Quaker. And he's spent the greater part of his life writing and provoking thought around the states of our heart as it relates to community, as it relates to education, as it relates to social change. I was introduced to his work by two equally wise voices who often sit in these seats, Louise and Scott Walker. You can read actually more about their work, primarily on that Events and Happenings turquoise sheets in there. It's called Life Work Direction. But they got me thinking and probing more into his work. They're going to be speaking more to some of our leaders about it in a couple weeks and giving materials out to our community groups to engage with over the fall. So if you're intrigued at all by any of the words this morning, know that Parker Palmer was the catalyst for a lot of them. And I'd encourage you to check out a community group in the fall if you'd like to explore more of his wisdom with other people. But he says that despite heartbreak being this inevitable and painful reality of life, there are in fact two ways that the heart can break. It can break open into a more vibrant life that looks like stretched capacity to hold more suppleness. Or it can break apart into shards of sharper and more widespread pain around us. And he goes on to explain that, you know, that the natural state of our heart And our response is actually in us from the very beginning. It's primitive to have this fight or flight response. That's how we're wired to respond to things that look like and feel like pain, to flee, to not engage, or to fight it. And yet he says we actually have more choices than that our heart can actually respond in a different way. And he illustrates this by telling this very cool Hasidic tale anchored in the text of the Old Testament. He says, there was a disciple that asked a rabbi, why does the Torah, these first five books of the Old Testament, tell us to place these words of God upon our hearts? The rabbi answers and says, it's because as we are, our hearts are closed. And so those words can't go anywhere. They just land on top of our hearts. And there they will stay until one day the heart breaks open and those words can actually fall in. And this image is a powerful one for me because I can visually see it, those things stacking up on top of a heart. For me, in the depths of crisis or hearing about cancer, it's emotion, right, that's stacking high upon my heart in a way that brings heaviness. And he says, if left untended, that tension, that weight will actually prove to be unbearable for our hearts. We can't sustain that. And so our heart becomes brittle, and it breaks apart into a million pieces. And sometimes those pieces are used as shards, as fragment grenades thrown at the ostensible source of our pain. And that's what happens when we don't know what to do with our pain. It shoots back, sends off in a reactive way more pain to people and the world around us. And I look back and realize that the first few days of Scott's diagnosis, I was definitely in that reactive state. I instantly, at those words of cancer, just buttoned down my heart, you know, from past pain and past stories of cancer that had gone not well. And yet I had all these emotions, and they needed somewhere to land. But because I couldn't quite figure out how to open my heart, they just sort of stacked up on top of my heart. And I would flip from worst case to best case scenarios. Worst case scenarios was entertaining this harsh reality that Scott would die. And I would start to think about, like, the timeline. Like, okay, he could die in 2 years, or he could die in 5 years. What would that look like? He could die in 7 years. What would that look like? And I would actually settle on an option. I'd be like, well, 5 years seems pretty good. Like, my kids would still be around. They could mow the lawn. Like, and if it was a shorter window, I would entertain, like, 2 years? Okay, well, that means I need to get, like, up to beat with what Scott does around the house, like the practicalities. Where does he get those light bulbs? Where does he order them from? But it's this harsh reality. It's this sinking kind of hole of despair to follow that train down, and it left me paralyzed without any movement, really. And then I would swing to the other end, the sunnier side, the best-case scenario. When he actually had that growth taken off his ear in the office, the doctor actually lost it for a minute. He was like looking around for it. And so I was often thinking, like, well, maybe it wasn't even Scott's diagnosis that we got on that phone call. Like, maybe it's not his biopsy that came back that we got word of. I'm sure the surgeon in a week is going to tell us that it was a mistake, that we don't need to worry about it, that it's fine. But again, I was up above reality, right? Not really engaging with anything that lent itself to movement, seesawing back and forth, flipping between these scenarios in a way that just lent to building more weight on top of my heart. And my heart did what Palmer says it will do. It started to shatter and splinter, and I became more reactive. Scott and I had this interaction the first day that we got the call, where, you know, we're looking at each other, stunned, don't know any information, and he says to me, well, what do you want to do? What do you think we should do? And I respond really reactively, and I'm like, what should I do? What do you want to do? I don't know what we should do. And it's just sort of this, like, visceral reaction of, like, I just want to throw it back at you. And he sort of pressed on gently, not letting on that I had just tried to eviscerate him with my words. And he says, well, maybe we could pray or read the Bible. Like, maybe that would be something we could do. And I just felt my heart like clenched down and my teeth and everything in me. And I was like, no, like, ew, I do not want to do that. And it was this very immediate, reactive posture of my heart. I had no interest in having my heart open, no interest in exploring what could be underneath those emotions. And I think to some degree, well, it's natural, right? We see that that's our primitive response. It's like going to a doctor's office and having your knee tested for a reflex. It's heroic not to actually have a response. And so I got a piece of it right, that my emotions were powerful and that they did have impact. But what I couldn't see was that our emotions are powerful indicators of what to do, of how to move, what the next steps could look like. And then I needed to have my heart start to break open for them to inform me of what my next steps should be. Palmer backs this up. He says, yes, we need to have our hearts broken in a different way. We need to have them broken open. And as the tale, that Hasidic tale that he tells, as we can let God's words actually fall into our hearts, those are words of love that can be the tools that start to break open and stretch our heart to hold greater capacity, to hold both pain and joy. Both of them, those things in the same container. And then that lets us have more compassion and understanding and movement to respond to people around us that they too are suffering, to hold their pain and their joy. So he suggests that we do this, we entertain this open heart by standing in the tension of life. He says that our human tendency is to want to go to one of those worst or best case scenarios, pessimism or optimism. So for me, if I had collapsed into that pessimism, it ultimately would have looked like corrosive cynicism to some degree, right? Everything that I interacted with, all the people that I interacted with, decisions I made would be laced with this idea that, well, Scott's going to die anyway, so it doesn't really matter. And so there's this grimness around it. Again, there's no change that can happen out of that. I'm just sort of sinking into that. And if I had collapsed into that pure possibility, I'm likely to float off into irrelevant idealism. You know, that like, it would be so amazing and lovely if only Scott didn't have cancer. But I'm floating above the fray. I'm disconnected to human struggle. And so it seems like those poles are apart, but Palmer says they actually bring us to the same spot. They bring us out of the action, out of the tension, where otherwise we could actually have a life-giving contribution go out into the world around us and for us. And so when I reacted strongly to Scott's suggestion, I wasn't yet able to stand in that tension, to see death and life in the same container. So how is it then that I move towards that? What do I have to do to think about standing in the tension? Palmer says there's three things we can do, and this is where your first set of notes will pick up on your program. The first, he says, is we must learn to acknowledge and name what we are feeling honestly and openly to ourselves and to others. So I had to be vulnerable. And I didn't want to be vulnerable. I didn't want to go look at all the history of the pain that was associated with cancer for me, to think about my dad dying too quickly, to think about my friend whose husband died way too young. It was too hard for me. It was too vulnerable. I didn't want to go there again. But Palmer says, in the same way that we learn to love from being around love in action, we need to do the same to learn how to hang in the tension. We need to be around people that do that and invite us in to try it on for ourselves rather than just reading about it or gaining knowledge about it. And so for me, that's ultimately what I did in those first few days. I immediately like called a couple of friends. I was like, we need to go for a walk. We did. And these are friends that I know have experienced heartbreak and pain and yet seem to be doing life and flourishing in life. So I wanted to hear from them. Tell me what your experience of standing in the tension has been. A friend of mine who lost her husband too soon came over that next day. She cooked me an egg, and she hung out with me most of the day, and she shared her real life experiences of this hanging in the tension. And she listened and asked me of what I was feeling. I talked to my neighbor who had lost a child when he was 2. I talked to friends who for a lifetime have battled with systemic racism. How is it that you stand in the tension? How is it that you still do life in a way that's productive, in a way that's loving? And they told me, and they listened to mine. And in all of those cases, never once did they oversubscribe sort of sunshine or try to fix me up. They just validated the pain and said, wow, this is hard, and this is a big deal, actually. They were human. They showed their humanness and asked for mine in return. And yet it's hard to do, and it's even harder to imagine what I think Palmer suggests next, which is to move directly to the heart of your pain. And allow yourself to feel the pain fully and expect God to cover you in that. Perhaps our human tendency is to try to be numb to our pain, to anesthetize it, find distractions, or to fight it, or blame, or attack. But Palmer says we need to go right into the pain and see what it is it has to teach us, and to come through that on the other side. I would add that you also should expect God to cover you in that vulnerability, that he'll be there for you. Upon hearing words that Scott had cancer, I went into my own fear really quickly and made every possible doctor's appointment that I could make for myself. Dentist, eyes, dermatology, full physical, all of the things. I was like, that was my entire day one day. And the physical, they said they couldn't get me in until October. And I was like, October? I could die by then. Like, you gotta get me in sooner. And the administrator on the phone sort of picked up, I think, on my intensity and asked a little bit about that, you know. So she heard the story of Scott. She shared her stories of skin cancer. And then she asked this question, which is, how are you feeling right now? And it is this direct to the heart of my pain question, where it just like pierced right in. And I was like, ooh, I'm feeling afraid. Like, I'm feeling really afraid. And then she says, well, what's your husband's name? I say the rosary every morning. I have a space for an extra name. And I would love to pray for your husband every morning. And I was like, wow, that is great. And I felt like God was in it for that moment, you know, to cover me in unexpected ways with a stranger on the phone. And it helped sort of nurture that vulnerability, I think, that I was extending. And to find his still small voice, I think, too, is a hard one to do, because in moments of crisis or hard news or injustice, it's not like the world stops, right? The phone calls keep coming in. The emails keep coming in. There's still a lot of stuff going on. And it's even harder when you're hurting, because it's harder to tap into that voice. But Palmer says, your third point, create a microclimate of quietude, allowing the turmoil to settle and an inner quietude to emerge. For me, this meant I needed to stop and actually ask God what was happening in that visceral reaction for me when Scott suggested prayer and the Bible. I mean, a pastor. I should want to do those things. But it was so visceral. So I did. I asked God, what's going on? What was that about? And I think in only the way that God can, he didn't answer that question directly. He just asked more questions of me, asked me to think about the pain that I had experienced in past bouts with cancer. What did that mean? Where was that landing for me? Was it still live? And so it was this processing of going through some of that pain a little bit. And I could realize some of the hurt was that I felt really vulnerable with God to say, like, I was asking for your presence, and for me, I tied it to positive outcomes, and it doesn't seem like that happened. And he said back, I felt like, oh, I was there, and I'm here now. And also, that that self-critical voice of yours that wants to say that that response was too harsh, where you're sort of identifying your visceral response as a reactive heart, that was actually the beginning of an open heart with me. And then all of a sudden I had this new filter. Through this quiet moment with God, the ability to see my pain for what it was, those were the tools that started to break my heart open to greater capacity. And I could see that that harsh response of mine was actually a response of standing in the tension. It held all of the heartache and pain. And then at the same time, I felt like underneath that, my entire body and everything I was feeling and saying was actually a prayer. That was prayer, a full body prayer. The words that I would find in the Bible encouraging that I could have read were actually in my heart. They were in my being. And so I was holding both that pain and the promise of something more and better in the same space. And that small, quiet moment with God actually helped me to see that and settle some of that turmoil in a way that brought me through to more. Stand in the tension, Palmer says. That's where the action is. That's where flourishing can bloom. And as I reread the words found in this Hebrews passage that's on your program, I was moved to read that these stories of the heroes of faith that we've heard about, that in a way I had never read them before, that for me drew our storylines closer into a shared, timeless heartbreak. So if you are inclined, you can read along with me this swath of scripture on your program. It says, by faith, these people overthrew kingdoms, ruled with justice, and received what God had promised them. They shut the mouths of lions, quenched the flames of fire, and escaped death by the edge of the sword. Their weakness was turned to strength. They became strong in battle and put whole armies to flight. Women received their loved ones back again from death. But others were tortured, refusing to turn from God in order to be set free. They placed their hope, though, in a better life after the resurrection. Some were jeered at, and their backs were cut open with whips. Others were chained in prisons. Some died by stoning. Some were sawed in half, and others were killed with the sword. Some went about wearing skins of sheep and goats, destitute and oppressed and mistreated. They were too good for this world, wandering over deserts and mountains, hiding in caves and holes in the ground. All these people earned a good reputation because of their faith. Yet none of them received all that God had promised, for God had something better in mind for us, so that they would not reach perfection without us. And it goes on in chapter 12. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a huge crowd of witnesses to the life of faith, let us strip off every weight that slows us down, especially the sin that is so easily tripping us up. And let us run with endurance the race God has set before us. We do this by keeping our eyes on Jesus, the champion who initiates and perfects our faith. Because of the joy awaiting him, he endured the cross, disregarding its shame. Now he is seated in the place of honor beside God's throne. Think of all the hostility he endured from sinful people, and then you won't become weary and give up. These are powerful words, powerful stories. These people stood in the tension. They looked, too, to known possibility in their day, right? Those first set of verses say they actually saw justice rule. They saw rules be over kingdoms overthrown and enemy armies sent away. But they also faced harsh realities, those next verses that come, of death and torture and oppression and mistreatment. And yet they stood in the midst of this, with never ever seeing all of the promises that God had spoken over them. They were never fulfilled. And yet we get the sense that their hearts were broken wide open with God's love, as evidenced by their continued action and movement. If we could have time to look at the stories that come before this in chapter 11, we would see those stories of Noah, of Abraham and Sarah, of Rahab and Moses, all of them continuing to move, but believing for something better than what their circumstances presented them. And this time, the reason it felt so different, I think, to read these verses was because it didn't feel like my story was actually separate from these stories. And it didn't feel like these words of faith and hope were a separate attachment that I had to Velcro onto my pain to have success. It was in me. Those words were in me. And in the earlier verses of this chapter, we get these words that these people still speak to us today because of their faith, that their voices too are my voice. And they speak to us, these ancients, so strongly of how to flourish in the midst of heartbreak. I think the first of which they tell us is on your program here. This is the second set of notes. Be rebellious. Hold on to faith and hope and keep moving. Faith and hope feel rebellious, I think, in this day and age. Like it was for Noah to build an ark or for the city of Jericho to fall down. They're rebellious acts. They're attention grabbers in our societal landscape. It feels audacious in some of our settings to have faith and hope. And I think I realized reading this that faith and hope aren't sentiments that start at the moment of our own suffering or pain. They don't pop up like word bubbles or like this carrot that's trying to bribe us through our suffering. They're actually in this deep-rooted aquifer that all of humanity has bled into for centuries, and one that all of humanity at any time can draw from. They are words that will seep deep into my heart in a way that makes them supple and nourishes my heart to be able to sustain and stand in that tension. Faith and hope, like values of love, justice, and mercy, are already components of our genetic makeup. We're descendants of those heroes of faith. And they're weighted, powerful keys to change and movement in our lives and in the world around us. Thomas Merton, the well-known mystical Catholic, says to this end, it's on your program, and I'm going to condense it down a little for time. It says, we're not called to respond to generalities, but to the concrete facts with which we are confronted day after day. A compassionate man can no longer look at these manifestations of evil and death as disturbing interruptions of his life, but rather has to confront them as an opportunity for the conversion of himself and his fellow human beings. I'm not going to condense it. I'm just going to keep going because it's too good. Every time in history that men and women have been able to respond to the events of their world as an occasion to change their hearts, an inexhaustible source of generosity and new life has opened, offering hope far beyond the limits of human prediction. Noah built an ark. Abraham lived in a tent like a foreigner. Moses' parents hid him for 3 months in the reeds. Rahab welcomed in spies. These heroes of faith responded to the concrete realities of their day. And God encouraged this by saying, I'll turn your weakness into strength, even in the midst of your heartbreak, so that you can have freedom to respond as you are hurt. My response looked like crying for 3 days. But I know a lot of people, when they felt wrong, they take action. They respond to that with an open heart. And it might look like protest to something that's actually wrong. It might look like education. Others have found their responses through art, through poetry. This morning, we're going to have an opportunity to listen to response of a voice in song. Band can come up. Mavis Staples, I don't know if you've heard of this artist. She's an amazing woman who started singing in the 50s with her family, the Staples Singers, and she went with Martin Luther King Jr. in the civil rights movement to cities and towns that he would speak in, and they would go and sing beforehand. And it's moving because she has a storyline of heartbreak, and yet she found a response to that that actually inspires us, I think, to stand in the tension. So here's the band and the song, Eyes on the Prize. Thank you. Thanks, guys. As the way the song suggests, keep your eyes on the prize and hold on. We get the hunch that this life is going to be a long race. We're going to need to hold on. And yet our human inclination, I think, when we're faced with pain is to try to figure out how to become victorious over it. But the words of the song say, hold on. And I think Palmer would agree with this, that we might not actually be able to claim victory over big values like love, peace, and justice and see that in our day. That maybe there's a different way, though, to measure our effectiveness and our efforts. And so he suggests this standard of faithfulness. He says, try this out. He says, think of someone you respect because he or she has lived a life devoted to high values. Maybe some of the ancients in the scripture, a Rosa Parks, a Nelson Mandela. At the end of the road, was that person able to say, wow, I'm sure glad I devoted my entire life to that job because now for generations after me, they don't have to worry about it. They can just check it off their to-do list. No, he says, our heroes take on impossible jobs and stay with them for the long haul because they live by the standard of faithfulness. And not sort of this high and mighty definition of faithfulness, but faithfulness to wake up every day and to put one foot in front of the other, to realize what it is we have in us, our gifts, our natural helps, to match with where we perceive the needs of our world to be. That's faithfulness. And this standard will actually keep us going in the ways that we know are possible in the world around us, despite discouragement of hard realities. And in that, we'll find ourselves in a cloud of witnesses. Third, be up for your role in breaking others' hearts. Be attentive, listen, and love. This leads to flourishing. I think we need to start believing that we can actually talk to one another with understanding and with compassion in a way that leads us forward to better love. In that song, we hear that phrase, the only chains that we can stand are the chains of hand in hand. Don't be chained to pessimism or to hatred or to fear. Instead, look to one another for a way forward in our world. Hebrews 6:11 says, our great desire is that you will keep right on loving others as long as life lasts, in order to make certain that what you hoped for will come true. And my hope is that we will indeed continue to break each other's hearts open to attentiveness, to more peace. And so after this service today, we're actually going to have a gathering, if this feels live for you, that you feel like you're in the midst of heartbreak yourself, to actually do this, to share with one another, to listen, and to pray for about an hour right here. And if I could deduce this talk down to one sentence, I think it would be this last point. Don't give up on God. I got an email from a friend that Scott and I were just getting to know over the last few months, right when Scott was diagnosed. And he essentially said this in his email. The only thing that counts is never giving up, sort of in that vastness of cancer that feels like there's nothing you can control. He says, this is one thing that can help. And it was moving to me because I knew the arc of his story. I knew that it entailed a lot of heartbreak. And yet he looked like somebody who was still flourishing and engaging love around him in powerful ways. And the last verse in that Hebrews 11 section says, think about all Jesus endured so that you will not become weary and give up. Jesus was the premier stand in the tensioner, right? He had heartache that he was facing in harsh ways. And he knew the possibility to come. And as I read that email from my friend, I realized, wow, right. Jesus has been standing in the gap with this person all along. He's been standing in his heartache. He's been standing in that tension with that person. And that was a mirror effect for me to realize, oh, that's what's at the crux of my heartbreak, is that I don't think that God's really in it with me. I've sort of given up that he's really there. And I needed to read between the lines of that don't give up encouragement and see for myself that that's what it was. And then I felt like I could clearly see his presence so steadily in those stories of the ancients, in Mavis Staples' story, in this story of this person who sent me an email, that God was there. And it helped me believe again that indeed God is with me. He cares for me in my pain. He's there with me. And it's pretty hard to give up on God, I think, when he keeps showing up. So Palmer says, as I said earlier, that to be able to stand in the tension means that we can have a life-giving contribution if we can kind of walk through that pain with an open heart. And so what's my contribution? I think my answer would be, I don't know. Not in a quip way, but in maybe a more of a long look at life. Maybe it's the timeline of Noah's or Rahab's or Martin Luther King Jr.'s, one that I'll never get to witness what that actual contribution has been. But perhaps my action each day is to wake up and remain open with a whole heart to this vast, messy thing that we call life. And maybe I get to show my kids that hope and faith are these deep-rooted things within us that help us stand in that tension and help us flourish. Let me pray for us before we hear some more words about how you could get prayer from our prayer team, and also before we enter into worship. So God, thank you that you don't leave us alone, that you give us freedom to lament and to be in our pain, and you give us freedom to respond to that with you in meaningful, powerful ways. And so God, wherever we are right now, whether our heart is in a posture that feels more closed or whether it feels like it might be entertaining, how to hold more capacity of joy and pain in the same place, I pray that you stand with us in that this morning. God, powerfully be with us. Shower your love on us, and may we feel it and be moved by it. In your name, amen.